This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is John Fabian Witt, who is the Allen H. Duffy Class of 1960 Professor of Law at Yale Law School. His most recent book is Lincoln's Code, The Laws of War in American History, which was awarded the 2013 Bancroft Prize, was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, and was selected for the American Bar Association's Silver Gavel Award, and was a New York Times Notable Book of 2012. His other publications include Patriots and Cosmopolitans, Hidden Histories of American Law, and the prize-winning book, The Accidental Republic, Crippled Working Men, Destitute Widows, and the Remaking of American Law. Professor Witt, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you. So nice to be here.
Where were you born and raised?
Philadelphia, Pennsylvania.
And looking back, how did your parents shape your thinking about the world?
Well, that's pretty powerfully. I mean, I might have tried to avoid it, but inevitably. My father was a history graduate student before he got drafted in the Vietnam War. He became a lawyer after serving as a conscientious objector. And so in some ways, I'm a lawyer, I'm a historian, I'm kind of following in his footsteps. My mother's influence is so pervasive I can't even identify it. Mm-hmm.
But tell us something. I mean,
so my mother is a community maker. She makes community in and around a neighborhood called Germantown in Philadelphia, which is a fabulously interesting neighborhood and was a great place to grow up, the greatest place I could have grown up.
And was there much discussion of the law and history around the dinner table?
Oh, yeah. I mean, to grow up in Philadelphia is to be surrounded by history. So I think there was a photograph of me in the Philadelphia Bulletin, the newspaper before the now closed, which on July 4th, 1976, on the bicentennial, was a big deal. And there's a picture of me, I think, on my father's shoulders, wearing a red, white, and blue hat and being part of the celebration of the bicentennial. And to be surrounded by the Liberty Bell and Independence Hall and Betsy Ross and the flag was an inspiration to do history from the beginning.
Where were you educated?
Quaker School, Germantown Friends School, right in Philadelphia, right in the neighborhood Germantown. And then I went to Yale College and ended up at Yale for a while. I got a graduate degree, PhD in history, and a law degree there as well.
When you went to Yale as an undergraduate, were you already committed to the law and history? Was it something that you knew you wanted to do?
You know, not when I arrived. I spent a lot of time thinking I would be an economist. But then maybe the gravitational pull of the influence of parents, for whatever reason, I ended up majoring in history. At the end of college, tried to choose between history graduate school and law school, and then decided I couldn't choose between them. So I did both.
Did you do first, or both at the same
time? I kind of did them at the same time. I alternated. Yale's a very flexible place. The law school's small, the history department's small, and so I was able to work out moving back and forth across the street.
And any particular mentors that stand out as an undergraduate, graduate student, or and law?
I was really lucky to have really extraordinary historians and lawyers to work with and learn from. David Brian Davis in the history department, as an undergraduate and then a graduate student, was an intellectual inspiration, an incredibly nice man as well, which I'm sure was a large part of it. But David Brian Davis has written books that will last and will survive the test of time. And then in the law school, a man named Bob Gordon, Robert Gordon, who's now at Stanford, and any number of other figures, Akhil Amar, any number of other people I worked with pretty closely.
And what was your dissertation on?
The dissertation was on industrial accidents. There was a century ago, a lot of people don't know this, but a century ago there was a crisis in industrial accidents in the United States, unlike anything the world had ever seen. And it transformed American law. It helped give rise to much of what we now know of as the modern state in the United States. It was the response two industrial accidents. It was a great project, turned out to be fabulous.
And this actually became your first book.
That's right. So this is The Accidental Republic is the name of this
and,
book.
And yeah. what you're tracing is a movement from free labor, which was the center of conversation and about how to treat labor, and where it moved to accidents, insurance, security, which is a kind of a major transformation of the economy, then reflected in the law.
Right. So if emancipation was about free labor, if the very definition of freedom after the Civil War became the freedom of the worker to work freely and choose, make his own way, and it was him, it's very gendered, which is interesting too. Once the workers are being maimed and killed in extraordinary numbers, there's a crisis for that whole way of life, that whole system of thought that freedom had given birth to. And so what the book does is it traces out the experiments of an entire generation around the turn of the 20th century to try to figure out how to restore some version of free labor, or how to alter free labor, or how to remake free labor for the world of risk and the world of the 20th century, which is the world that we're familiar with now.
And a theme emerges in that book, which is a theme that you're very interested in, comes up again and again, which is there are critical periods in our history, and there are alternative paths that the law can take. And this was your first example of that.
Yeah, no, that's true. So contingency is one of the things that I'm most interested in finding as a historian. I think it's one of the distinctive contributions that historians can make, is to reveal the existence of alternative possibilities, that the world we live in now isn't inevitable, that it could have come out quite differently. And of course, what that means is that we could make things happen differently into the future as well.
Mm-hmm. What led you to this interest, this early interest in tort law? Where did that come from?
Yeah. Well, so one of my teachers at law school, at Yale Law School, was Guido Calabresi, who's a judge on the Second Circuit, United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit, still teaching torts at Yale now, has taught torts at Yale for decades. And in Guido's torts class, Calabresi goes by Guido. Mm-hmm. In Guido's torts class, you spend the first several weeks on a single case involving an injured railroad worker in 1911. It ends up in the New York Court of Appeals, the High Court for the State of New York. And that 1911 case, to get my mind wrapped around that, I needed a lot more time than my classmates did. So I spent a couple years on that case, writing a dissertation about it, essentially, whereas most of my classmates got done with it just after a couple of weeks.
Mm-hmm. And this, by the way, is another theme that emerges. You're very interested in storytelling and narratives of people, because people are very important as actors in your analysis.
Yeah, so
not to say the only thing that's important to you.
Right. Yeah. Well, so stories are another thing that historians can bring to the table, and I think of them as incredibly supple and subtle ways to tell, to draw an account of the human experience. So, you know, when I was flirting with being an economist as an undergrad, one of the great thrills of it was the ability to draw up models for human behavior and focus on a few perspicuous dimensions that could allow you to get some access and insight into how human beings behave. And I admire that and enjoy doing it still sometimes as a teacher in law school classes. But you lose so much of the texture and the fine-grained account of how human beings behave. And so the story allows you to tell things in their full complexity. And I just find that hugely appealing. And I also just like stories. I just own up to that.
And so I'm curious about the origins of that. And I should mention here that your books are extremely lucid and well-written for an outsider who's not a lawyer or a historian. And so the question is, where did you learn to write so well? And what got you interested in stories? Was it law case studies?
Well, yeah, law school works and the law works around cases and particular stories. That's for sure. And I think that may be part of it. I think it's just maybe an effort to understand how human beings tick. What makes them tick? Where do their motivations come from? Where do their projects come from? And stories are one of the ways you get at that. I'm a novel reader and a film watcher, and all those things organize themselves around stories. I'm just not creative enough to generate stories of my own. And so history helps me with that by giving me things that actually happened.
I like to ask my guests, what are the skills and temperament required for the work that they do? And in, you wear two hats, a historian and a lawyer. So talk a little about that. In other words, are the skills and temperament very different for the two, or are they not that different?
Well, they're different and they're the same in a number of ways. But I think lawyers are principally interested in trying to figure out how to take the past, to take the accumulated body of legal materials that we have, whether it's statutes or cases from the past, and make the best that we can make for the future out of those materials. Historians are dealing with the past too, but they don't have an obligation to make the best we can make of those materials. They have an obligation to try to tell it the way it really was, the way it really was. And so that's, there are some similarities there, but also some really important differences. And to me, the excitement is to be in both of those disciplines at the intersection of those two things. I just find that, you know, super, super interesting and exciting.
And in terms of temperament, I mean, you really... Your especially your historical studies, you're really in the archives. It really is a question of patience, perseverance.
I learned about this when in my accident book. I commuted to Brooklyn, New York from New Haven for a good while of writing that book, and I bought a frame backpack and carried the collected annual reports of the New York State Insurance Commissioner in the 19th century back and forth along the Metro North train. And now those are boring books. They're just boring. And so the project was to try to tell a good story out of these other seemingly boring materials. And I think there were good stories to tell. There were the, you know, lives and misfortunes of thousands and thousands of people in those insurance reports. That's what insurance is about, is protecting against misfortune. And so that's what I do when I'm in the archives, is I look for stories that I can tell that people don't know about. And I think, you know, lawyers do something of the same, that is, lawyers have to read very carefully to draw out the salient facts. And so there's some parallels there.
And what about writing? Did you get that those skills at Yale?
That's interesting. I mean, I think I get those skills the way I imagine most writers get them, which is from reading, just reading voraciously and then wanting to produce things as beautiful as the things that I've been able to read.
Mm-hmm. As a historian of the law, you are drawing on tasks that lawyers do. So lawyers, as you just said, lawyers do history. They, it's a different kind of history. It's the history of precedents, of what happened before, what other courts have. Whereas, as a historian, there's a difference. What exactly is that difference, if I could draw that out of you, between a historian of the law and lawyers who are, by the nature of their work, historians?
Well, there's a saying for this. It's the lawyer does what's called law office history. Law office history, and that's sometimes said pejoratively by historians, but I don't think of it as in a pejorative sense. What they're doing is that the lawyer who does law office history is doing history for a project, for a purpose, trying to accomplish a particular end, help a client decide a case in the here and now, something along those lines. The historian, by temperament maybe, but by professional obligation, is supposed to look at the past and take it on its own terms. Now, the historian chooses which topic to look at. That is often driven by presentist concerns, things in the here and now. But once the historian gets to those materials, the project is to think about them for their own sake and to try to make sense of them on their own terms.
I'm interested in what are some common themes that emerge in your work that would tell us what being a historian of the law is about. And I found a very revealing quote in the Lincoln book, the Lincoln's Code, which we'll talk about in a minute. You say, law of any kind does not develop independent of its context or untethered from the needs and interests of the most concerned parties. So it's about a larger context. Talk a little about that.
Well, absolutely. So I think sometimes there are people who imagine that law must come down from the heavens or be in the heavens. It's some magical, has some magical property that makes it live in the world of reason rather than the world of experience. This is a famous line from Oliver Wendell Holmes, Jr. The life of the law has not been logic, it's been experience. And Holmes was obviously right about that. The life of the law comes from what human beings bring to it, the projects, the goals, the aspirations, the interests, sometimes base interests, sometimes glorious ideals. And it's that mix of all those things that comes to make what the law is. And the effort to treat it as a domain of pure reason and principle is to miss what really makes it tick and really why we'd want to have it in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And so your skills as a historian provide that sense of texture that enriches the context and makes one aware of all the different things that are going on, because in your books there is a sense of interest group behavior, of the importance of ideas, the importance of individuals, the importance of institutions and the history of those institutions.
Well, that's right. And all those parameters seem to me to be critically important in developing sufficient accounts of the way the past works. And now if you get too granular in these stories, well, it's just one damn thing after another, and you haven't revealed any internal logic or any structure, any recurring patterns. So the balance is to find ways to take advantage of the capacity of stories to tell things as they really were, while also pulling out some generalized patterns and some lessons, at least for understanding the material, maybe even sometimes lessons about how we ought to behave today.
I want to go over a point that we talked about a minute ago, because another theme that emerges is these critical turning points where alternative paths present themselves and a decision is made one way or another. So this rich understanding of the context really helps you see the paths that we may no longer see, because those paths were the roads not taken.
Yeah, right. And the job of the historian, as I understand it in these moments, is to draw out the paths and describe them as plausible. That it's easy to say, oh, look, somebody thought of something which didn't come to pass, but that doesn't mean you've been able to describe it as something that could actually have come about. And so, especially in the accident book, what I did there was I tried to lay out almost a half dozen alternative ways of organizing a system of accident law and insurance, each one of them of which could have been models for the social insurance state of the 20th century. But I didn't want to just identify them. I wanted to build them out and describe the ways in which they were being built, being made, being developed on the ground, so that the reader gets a sense this is actually a plausible path that might have been taken. Sometimes they're paths that are taken elsewhere. I mean, history is a little bit like the past is a little bit like a foreign country, and so it's a form of comparativism. That is, the experience of other countries can sometimes show us how things might work in a different way, and so can the experience of the past.
Your two recent books, The Lincoln's Code, which we'll talk about in a minute, and The Patriots and Cosmopolitans: The Hidden Histories of American Law, can be seen as responses to the events of 9/11, not in the sense that those events overdetermined what you did, but in the sense that they shaped your sense of what the problems were that you wanted to look at. Talk a little about that.
Well, 9/11 had a big impact on my thinking about the law. I mean, I lived about a half mile north of the Trade Towers on Greenwich Street in New York on 9/11. I was actually in a voting booth when the first plane hit, right on the West Side Highway there. And that day and the days that followed left a big impression on me. We were very fortunate. We were safe. Our loved ones were safe. A lot of people weren't as fortunate as we were. But I wanted to think more about international law, the kinds of controversies that quickly followed as the United States began to respond in the months and years thereafter. So a lot of it was motivated by thinking about the way in which the United States was in the world And thinking about the international influences on American law. It's also true that in the field of legal history, I think one of the next big questions for us is the history of international law. And it's a field that's booming right now, independent of developments on the ground, although of course always engaged with them. But because the field is set up now to want to know about the history of international law, we've got a lot of literature on the history of domestic law, and international law is a kind of unwritten frontier.
And in pursuing these interests on your part, there is a focus inevitably on national identity, nationalism, what that means as American law responds to external influences, say in international law, or international examples, and how they impact us and lead to a reassertion, really, of American nationalism and national identity.
Yeah, well, so my second book, the one just before this most recent one, Lincoln's Code, is entitled, as you said, Patriots and Cosmopolitans. And what I wanted to take up was these twin impulses that run through American history, an impulse to a kind of nationalism or patriotism. And I certainly felt that in the days after 9/11. I think almost everybody, maybe everybody in New York City did. And then on the other hand, a kind of cosmopolitanism. That is, the United States is sometimes aspired to be bigger than just itself, has aspired to stand for ideals and principles that are global, that are the right thing to think, independent of where you happen to be in the world. We're a beacon on the hill, as it were, for the entire world. And so those twin impulses, I wanted to explore them in the history of the law. I definitely felt them inside myself, still do. Nation states do wonderful things, and they're also obstacles to the accomplishment of lots of other good things. And so I wanted to pursue that through the history of American law.
And you went about doing that and tell the lives of several individuals throughout American history in different periods of American history. And I wanted to focus on the last two chapters, and in telling the story of individuals, and in the earlier chapter, you focus on a woman attorney, and I have her name here, and I'm going to find that name. Remind me,
Crystal Eastman.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Crystal Eastman. That's terrible that I lost that name. And in telling about her life, it's a fascinating account. And tell us a little about her and the themes that she was interested in as a lawyer.
Well, the reason I picked up her story, first of all, she gets started in industrial accident reform. I met her in my first book. And then noticed that she made a turn right around 1908, 1909, and became much more interested in questions of world peace, and internationalism was the word that she used to describe it. And Crystal Eastman is a lawyer trained at NYU in the first decade of the 20th century, at a time when there weren't many lawyers. She couldn't find a job practicing law. Not even liberal law firms would hire her because she was a woman. And so she found ways to be in the law and to work in the law that didn't require her to go through the old boys' networks.
And there were very few lawyers, women lawyers at that
age. Absolutely. Yeah. And the thing that she saw that I admired and admire still to this day, and it's the reason why she's the center of that chapter, is that she saw that nation states aren't themselves inevitable, that they're a particular way of carving up the planet, creating governance structures, allowing us to engage in democratic self-government, do lots of good things. But she thought, and a whole bunch of people in her generation thought so along with her, that the rivalries among nation states were terribly dangerous, that they produced things like World War I, and that the nation state form itself was really problematic and needed to be transcended. Now, this is an idea that lots of people in the 20th century had. We have the League of Nations. We have the Charter of the United Nations, all of which are trying to find supranational, transnational structures. And she's part of the early cusp of that 20th century idea that the nation state is the problem. And so exploring her story was a way of thinking about these funny containers of human life called nation states.
And interestingly enough, and I demonstrated that by not remembering her name, she's not well known.
No, not at all. Her brother, Max Eastman, is a little bit better known. He was an editor of something called The Masses, which is an important World War I radical magazine. And then he becomes an important literary figure in the middle of the 20th century. She gets sick in the 1920s and dies tragically young.
It's interesting because the evolution of her career is really indicative of this, these cosmopolitan influences. So she was in industrial accidents, and she studied at Columbia or NYU learned about looking at large-scale problems, which ultimately sociological analysis leads to a European way of studying problems. And she moved from that back to emphasizing the individual when the war brings to America a concern with national security and the espionage acts.
Right. She's a fabulously interesting intellectual person. She has an intellectual journey through a bunch of different ideas in the early part of the 20th century. She's a progressive for a little while. She becomes a radical. She moves through different places along with the intellectual currents of the day. And her own experience really helps her see things and add to those ideas. So as a woman, she marries a British national. And she marries a British national at a time when doing so strips her of her American citizenship. Just automatically, by statute enacted by Congress. And so she sees up front and personal the consequences of the way nation states are organized in her personal life through this moment. And it's part of what motivates her.
And interestingly enough, because of the Espionage Acts, civil liberties became more important. But someone like Crystal saw civil liberties as a means to the end of these cosmopolitan ideas about world government and so on. But in the end, she loses out to a man who is well known, Roger Baldwin, who ultimately creates the American Civil Liberties Union, but is really focused on domestic issues. His background was in domestic law, and so cosmopolitanism becomes civil liberties because of this assertion of national identity and nationalism in a way. Is that an oversimplification?
No, that's a great way to tell the story. I mean, Crystal Eastman was a dreamer. You know, she has an aspiration, and she sees an ideal far off in the distance. And a lot of people who are more successful in the world, really in the end, you compromise with it. And Roger Baldwin is someone who compromised with the world in order to accomplish really amazing things. But he makes big compromises in order to accomplish those things. He's an organizer who insists on practical reform. And abolishing nation states is not a practical reform. It wasn't going to happen then. It's not going to happen now. We see that in Eastern Europe right now with the refugee and migrant crisis, the nation state reasserting itself. So Crystal Eastman was a dreamer, and it's useful sometimes to think about dreamers, to focus on them, because they highlight things that we don't see otherwise.
And I guess the virtue of this history, as I read it, you understand the origins of what we see these days, people who believe that the UN could solve all of our problems when in reality it doesn't.
Right, and there is no UN for her to claim on, to try to appeal to at that moment. And so what she does is she invents this idea of civil liberties. She invents civil liberties as a way to hold off the nation state, to create some space for voluntary organizations to develop ideas of internationalism and to create an internationalist spirit in the first two decades of the 20th century.
The next chapter in that book pairs Roscoe Pound, a famous Harvard dean who was favorable to administrative law in the beginning of his career, but then became a spokesman for the Association of Trial Lawyers. And you pair him with Melvin Belli, both men, both well-known. It's a fascinating account of how the trial lawyers became a way through interest group politics to essentially reassert national identity and America's sense of its own institutions and to use those institutions to essentially benefit the self-interest of lawyers and presumably their clients.
Well, one of the interesting questions in the history of American law is why is it that certain features, certain experiments, certain structures get seen as un-American? You know, how does that come to be? I mean, it's a little bit of a mystery. And so one of the things I wanted to tell in this story was the self-conscious use of the lobbying power of the legal profession in the middle of the 20th century to hold off the growth of the New Deal state, to hold off the growth of bureaucracy, administration, and the New Deal, and to do it in order to protect the common law courts and the jury trial. Now, in part, there's a lot that's appealing about the common law courts and the jury trial, and we know there are pathologies in the welfare state, absolutely. But what was interesting to me was the way in which the lawyers who started to tell these stories about the un-American nature of the New Deal were doing so on behalf of the self-interested project of keeping the contingency fees flowing. And so that was a story that I had a great time telling. And the relationship between Pound, who had himself once been one of these bureaucratic reformers, the story of the relationship between him, an aging Pound, and Melvin Belli was just too good to pass up.
And the politics of both Baldwin and Pound and Belli, although very different in terms of the, you know, on the liberal conservative spectrum, in the end, it's about falling back on American institutions, American identity, to assert the importance and the dominance of a particular sector of the law. So it's American, and it's embedded in our sentiments, you call it, and our institutions, to take this path to the law.
Right. This has been one of the ways in which the nation state asserts itself in our history and comes to play such a powerful role in our history is by creating institutions that people like Crystal Eastman can't actually get around. They can alter them. They can introduce something like civil liberties, a really important tradition. But those institutions have such gravitational force. And so one of the things that the Belli Pound chapter was designed to bring out, their story, is the way in which those institutions, those traditions, bring people back to the nation state time and time again. There's power to be had by calling on the traditions and institutions that the nations of the world have created.
An interesting theme that I discovered, which reminds me now of you having said you were considering economics, because the people who lose out in these stories essentially have a sociological approach to the problems that are being addressed, that they want to look at what the data tells them about the large-scale project and which way to go. And that was true of the administrative law that Pound supported in the beginning of his career. And it's true in the case of the woman we just talked about.
That's true, yeah. So one of the things that I hope to bring out in the Pound-Belli chapter is that it's not clear to me that one version, the sociological, was better or worse than the common law.
Right.
In some ways, the common law, and this was the genius of Belli, not so much Pound's work, but the genius of Belli, was to recreate in the common law private administration as a substitute for public administration. So it turns out that in the tort system we have now, the trial is a rare event. What really happens in the tort system is settlement in boardrooms between insurance companies and sophisticated plaintiffs' lawyers who create the same kinds of grids for settling cases that the bureaucrats in the public side have as well. And so I was interested there in showing the way in which particular kinds of ideas about Americanness had these unintended consequences of, you know, keeping with administrative bureaucracy, which after all just saves us too much money. I mean, it's too efficient to not have it. And yet we have it in the private side rather than the public side in the United States.
And this is not just true in tort law. It extends to other areas
of the law. Yeah. Think, for example, of Obamacare, which runs through private insurance companies. The use of private mechanisms for delivering public goods is, you know, a central theme for American political scientists who study the provision of the American welfare state, and also is a theme that comes out in American law.
And so in that's an argument for history if I ever heard one, so that it gives you if you wanted single payer, your history not to say you're taking a position on this, but by understanding the complexity of the past and where we are today, you can understand the difficulty of implementing a single payer.
Yeah, you'd want to know this history to make a strategy.
Yeah.
No matter what you wanted, you'd want to take this into account. Yeah, that's for sure.
Your most recent book, for one for which you won the Bancroft Prize, is Lincoln's Code. What was Lincoln's Code, and how did it come about?
So Lincoln's Code is a text that the Union Army issues in April of 1863, and it's the first, it's the modern world's first restatement of the customary rules of international armed conflict. It has 157 articles. It's got rules about torture, prisoners of war, legitimate targets and illegitimate targets, the whole array of things that we think of as being the laws of armed conflict, which since 9/11 have been really salient for us. They're all there in this text that the Union Army issued in 63.
And as your history tells us, America had paid lip service to the rules of law, even though we had individual leaders who might have done particular things in wars. One thinks here of President Jackson and his fight with the Indians, or George Washington in the early part of his career, that they may have done things that did not abide by the rules of law. But overall, we embraced the rules of law with one important exception. And it is that insight on your part that really is eye-opening. What was the problem that the U.S. had with the rules of war, one particular element of it, before the Civil War?
Well, the thing that causes the Lincoln administration to need to issue this pamphlet is that since 1775, the American position had been that the laws of war don't allow civilized states to free enemy slaves in wartime. This is something that the last royal governor of Virginia did, Lord Dunmore, on his way out. You see, he announced that he'd free the slaves of rebels who made it to British lines. And from that moment on, the American planter class and then the American government is committed to the idea that you can't free slaves in wartime. And that commitment, which John Quincy Adams carries on in the War of 1812 and then later as Secretary of State and President, that project to protect slavery from wartime, which was hugely important for the strategic interests of the United States, to keep war if a European power had invaded, to keep it away from the slave plantations, which might be like a tinderbox. That was the worry.
And the worry, let's emphasize this, the worry was that if you freed the slaves, there would be mass insurrection and all sorts of terrible events with examples from history like the Haiti Rebellion.
Right, exactly. The specter of Haiti looms over much of the early part of the 19th century. It comes to stand for, it was misunderstood in large ways by the planters, but nonetheless, in their misunderstanding, it comes to stand for the risk of freeing slaves in a moment of armed conflict and the kinds of race wars and atrocities that might arise out of it. So that fear is something that really helps to shape the military strategy of the United States during the entire antebellum period.
So this is a perfect example of what you're saying. So before the Civil War, here is an international body of law that essentially we embrace in all respects except for one. And in this particular case, namely the rules about freeing slaves in war, there is absolute, total resistance by all of our founding fathers and the elites that we have through our history up until Lincoln.
Yeah, I mean, the Americans push really hard to establish a rule about slavery in wartime. And, you know, when John Quincy Adams goes to his British counterpart to negotiate the Treaty of Ghent in 1814 to end the War of 1812, his British counterpart says, well, you know, John, that's not the rule. So it's the United States that really gets out at the forefront of trying to make private property and private property in slaves in particular immune from wartime, from the violence of war. And that then comes back to haunt the Lincoln administration come the fall of 1862. You know, once Lincoln decides on emancipation, his administration then needs to figure out what to do with this longstanding tradition of insisting that this rule is a cardinal rule in international law.
And if we get into the details of the conduct of the war, not freeing the slaves becomes a real problem. So whatever humanitarian ideas Lincoln had about that the slave should be freed as a matter of principle, it's really the particulars of the war that are giving him that final push. Well, give me some examples of those particulars. Why did the slavery become such a conundrum?
Well, it becomes such a conundrum in large part because the slaves make it a conundrum. So, you know, right from the beginning of the war in the spring of 1861, slaves row across to Fortress Monroe in Virginia, leaving Confederate lines and coming to Union lines. And Union commanders, right there, it's General Butler, have to decide what to do with these slaves who arrive. And the initial solution or the initial sort of patched together framework is to call the slaves that make it to Union lines contraband. Now, contraband is a term from international law. It's just not a term that had anything to do with the situation to which it was being applied. It's a term that has to do with the property that's useful in war found on a neutral vessel on the high seas. And what Butler does is he appropriates that term from the international law of the sea context and applies it in this new place to try to begin to grapple with what to do with the slaves in wartime. And from there, it just gets harder as the months go by.
You make a distinction in American history and American ideas between notions of justice and notions of humanitarianism. Explain that distinction and then how that, in a way, helps us understand Lincoln's decision process.
Well, you know, one of the things that legal history does is it helps us highlight the moral structure of the legal institutions, legal rules we have today. And here's a really good example. So the moral structure of the laws of war in the middle of the 19th century and today is a structure that tries to set justice aside. The question when we deal with the international laws of armed conflict is not which side is right, which side is wrong, which side is just, which side is unjust. The questions are, assuming both sides are right for the purposes of regulating, how do we regulate this armed conflict? And so you don't ask who's in the right and who's in the wrong. And that was true in the middle of the 19th century, too. It was the 19th and 18th centuries' great advance on the early modern law, which actually had asked who's in the right and who's in the wrong. So it was a law that was focused on humanitarianism at the expense of justice. And what the American Civil War does is put justice back on the table. Because emancipation is a project for justice. Lincoln says that. He says when he issues the Emancipation Proclamation, he says this is an act of military necessity and an act of justice. So he's put justice back on the table in a way that potentially could have unbalanced the humanitarian rules of the laws of war. That's the tension that runs through between justice and humanity in the laws of war.
And interestingly enough, to go back to the themes that you're pursuing, in this particular case, the international principle of freeing slaves is embraced by America when the necessity of war pushes Lincoln to make that choice. And philosophically, as you've just said, he decides that, well, we don't know whether the Confederates are right or we're right. Well, we have to believe that we are in the right.
There's this great moment in the fall of 62 as Lincoln's trying to come to a conclusion about whether or not to do emancipation. And he takes some notes. He takes some notes. And what he does is he recapitulates the intellectual history of the international laws of war. And he does this. It's not like he'd been to graduate school in just war theory. He hasn't. What he's done is he's read some law books by William Blackstone, and he's read Shakespeare. He's read Henry V. And with that, with those things, and with his natural genius, he's able to recapitulate the history. He says, well, you know, I know that we Union folk are praying to God, and we think we're in the right. I know that the Confederate soldiers pray to God as well. So I know that what we're supposed to do in the laws of war is assume that we don't know who's in the right. But how can I have that posture if I've committed hundreds of thousands of men to harm's way? And so Lincoln sees that tension, and sees that tension better than anyone else who thinks about the laws of war in the middle of the 19th century.
And his administration commissions a Columbia law professor named Lieber to draft these. Lieber's had become known because his lectures at Columbia had been printed in the New York Times. And Lieber's background is very interesting because he's a German of origin. He's a European. He knows Clausewitz. He's actually witnessed war, as I recall. So he is in a way a draftsman that is bringing the European sense of the rules of war, but also the necessity of what you must do in war to the table.
Yeah, well, Lieber is just is one of the great great forgotten characters of the American Civil War. And what he helps us see is that the laws of war don't get adopted in order to constrain the people who adopt it, or in order to hide, in order to tie behind the back the hands of powerful states. The laws of war get adopted by powerful states. The multilateral treaties, beginning in the Hague Conventions of 1899, moving through to the Geneva Conventions of our own time, are conventions, treaties that get adopted by powerful states. And Lieber sees that. He's a Prussian. He comes of age in the era in which the Prussians are trying to overthrow Napoleon, kick him back out of Berlin. He's shot on the way back to Paris, chasing Napoleon back to Paris. But it doesn't make him a pacifist. Instead, he sees war as the kind of thing which, though tragic, is occasionally necessary, and it's necessary to sustain the moral virtue of free people. So his code is not the code of what he would have called a mawkish humanitarian. He has disdain for the mawkish humanitarian, who he thinks is secretly a pacifist. And instead, he has a code that's fierce. It's a code designed to allow the Union Army to win a war.
And in this code, in addition to saying, making it the code compatible with Lincoln's intention to free the slaves, there is a rule against torture. There is insights about, well, who is an enemy combatant and so on.
Yeah, the code, the central organizing principle of the code, and this is why I think it's Lincoln's code properly rather than Lieber's, although international lawyers have always called it Lieber's, but the central organizing principle is the military necessity idea that Lincoln had invoked in September of 1862 when he announced the Emancipation Proclamation, the preliminary proclamation. And that organizing idea runs through the entire code. And so when Lieber brings up a question like prisoners of war or legitimate targets, civilians and soldiers, he's always got in the back of his mind a carve-out for situations of necessity. And so the code says you may not execute prisoners of war, but then it says unless you really have to. And he, too, may have been thinking about Henry V right there, Shakespeare's Henry V, in which a famous order is given, not clear whether it's carried out, but is given in a moment of extremis in the battle to kill prisoners behind the front lines. So there are always these carve-outs for military necessity, except one, except in the case of torture. And torture, Lieber says, is simply not permitted. There's no carve-out. It's not something that civilized states can do and remain true to themselves. He's not worried, I don't think, about the moral status of the enemy soldier, nearly so much as he is about the moral status of his guys, of the people who'd have to perform the torture in question.
Now, in the end, we embrace a humanitarianism, but at the same time, there's an understanding of the conflict with this principle of justice, namely that we have to believe our cause is right, you know, or we're not going to win this thing. And we see the effect on humanitarianism in the whole prisoners of war and exchange business, where because the South, once slaves were freed, would not allow captured black soldiers to be freed, then all negotiations about the exchange of soldiers broke down, making the Union soldiers who were not black really suffer.
Yeah, this is one of the places where you can really see the justice-humanitarianism tension. So the reason Lincoln needs to issue this code is not just to reverse the 85-year tradition starting in 1775 of insisting that the laws of war don't allow you to free enemy slaves. It's also to deal with the consequences in the management of the conflict, of moving to emancipation and of arming black soldiers. So Jefferson Davis and James Seddon, the Secretary of War of the Confederacy, and Davis, of course, is the president of the Confederacy, have announced in no uncertain terms that black soldiers in Union uniform will not be treated as soldiers. They'll be treated as criminals. They're either black free abolitionists from the North who are stirring up a slave insurrection, which is unlawful in the law of, under the law of Georgia, South Carolina, Mississippi, and so on, or they're black slaves who've escaped from a plantation and are themselves a criminal for having done so and then stirring up an insurrection as well. So the idea is that Southern state courts are going to hold trials and punish, often by execution, black soldiers enlisted in the Union Army. And what the code does is it insists that the laws of war don't allow for discrimination on the basis of race, that they require that states recognize the privileges of soldiers for everybody in the enemy uniform. And so that problem helps propel the code forward. And what it does is it causes a breakdown in prisoner exchanges. Once the Union insists on following the international law rules set out in the code, the prisoner exchanges break down because the Confederacy is not willing to trade black soldiers as part of prisoner exchanges. And what we get is things like Andersonville. So Andersonville is the result, the terrible prison in Georgia where tens of thousands die. That's the result of the end of prisoner exchanges. And what the Lincoln administration is doing there is insisting on what's right at the expense of humanity. And you see that tension there again.
How does your study help us evaluate the response to 9/11 to think more clearly about it?
Well, one of the things I wanted to understand when I jumped into this was where did the response to 9/11 and the controversial pieces of it, the enhanced interrogation, and the torture, in particular, also now drone strikes and things like that, where did those things fit in the long tradition of American history? And there was a sense that we were in uncharted territory, that we were in unprecedented territory. And I think that what Lincoln's code is centrally designed to do is to show that that's just not right. Every generation of American soldiers and statesmen has had its own crisis in the laws of war. It's pervasive. And what's pervasive is moral challenge, and the law is trying to keep up with the basic moral structure of armed conflict. So what we see actually in our struggles now with ISIS and the like is the reproduction of a series of problems about how to deal with the laws of war that we've had since the founding and before, since the Seven Years' War, 20 years before the Republic gets started.
And my sense in reading your book is, both the Cosmopolitan book and the Lincoln book, is that you then see what's going on today kind of in a different light. It doesn't necessarily mean that you change your position, but you wind up saying, oh, that's where this comes from. And, oh, this was handled in a somewhat different way in the past.
Yeah, I mean, the effort to bring Al-Qaeda members to justice at Guantanamo is part of the long struggle over whether or not justice should be a part of armed conflict. And it reproduces some of the same debates that were had in the second half of the 19th century in Indian wars on the frontier. It reproduces some of the debates had about military commissions during the American Civil War. And each one of those instances has been an instance in which the effort has been made, the impulse has been felt to bring justice back into the equation, since after all, who can leave justice out? Right and wrong ought to be front and center. And if you violate the rules, if you act in a wrongful way, oftentimes with terrible, terrible consequences, as on 9/11, then surely justice should be front and center, and punishment should be the language that we use and the project that we're engaged in. But the laws of armed conflict have tried to get people to pull back from justice out of fear that fighting for justice will just produce a downward spiral and just make things worse, not better. So we can see, for example, that tension just running through our history and reproduced now again today.
When I think about your writings and how they help us understand the context of critical moments, I'm struck by the relevance of the kind of work you do to the kind of problem we face today with the sharing economy. for example. And so I'm not asking you to come up with a solution to that problem. What I want to ask you is, what are the sorts of things that a historian would want to look at in understanding the future of technologies like Uber in the context of long-established rules about municipal rights of taxis, of labor rights, of employment, and so on. So I'm not asking for a solution to the problem, but in other words, think out loud about a historian of the law would think about this.
Yeah, I think it's a good example. It seems to me that we're in a hinge moment. I'm thinking out loud here with you, but I think it's a hinge moment, and it's a hinge moment because, as I understand it, outfits like Uber, Airbnb are challenging the existing legal regulatory structure. They're essentially saying, we think that crowdsourcing and ratings, by customer ratings, are a better way to do safety in taxis, better way to rate the experience and regulate the safety of the experience in hotels and quasi-hotels. And it's a challenge to the old model of an inspector with a license. And that's the model that we have now. And so we're seeing a battle between those two forms. And it'll be really interesting to see how that plays out. I'm sure that the sharing economy institutions have shown us new ways to do some things that we hadn't known how to do nearly as well before. And I'm also sure that they're, in some other ways, skirting some rules that we're going to have to try to figure out how to reimpose.
And then in the end, it's really going to be about interest group behavior. Who's going to get mobilized to either be for or against this? It's also about the lawyers who can help us understand how this fits into what you call the institutions and the sentiments that define American nationalism.
Yeah, and it's a good thing. I mean, I think, one of the things that we might see here is that the hotel industry and the taxi cab industry, they're going to be interests pushing back the other way. And they're going to be pointing to things like the fact that I think many Uber drivers, I don't really know what I'm talking about here, right? I'm going to say something irresponsible. Yeah. But many Uber drivers, I imagine, aren't properly insured. Right? I think this must be pervasive, right? Mm. And as that kind of thing comes out, as accidents happen and people aren't able to recover on policies, as insurance companies keep getting surprised to learn that their insureds are Uber drivers, we're going to see the law have to come to terms with that kind of thing.
Well, with a set of problems like that before us, and having walked you through some of the problems that you've dealt with, my last question will be this. How would you advise students to prepare for the future, especially if they want to go into law? And should they become historians too?
Well, they absolutely should become historians. One of the great virtues of being a historian, well, two virtues. One is you haven't ruled out any methodology. You can do economic history. You can do the history of sociology. You can do the history of English literature, right? So history is a way of not ruling out a methodology. It's, in some ways, it's kind of a cheat as a result of that. But the real reason to study history is that otherwise you're like an amnesiac walking through time and space. And so having some sense of the kinds of features of the human experience allows you to make sense of the meaning of the kinds of things we do today and hopefully tomorrow.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being here. Let me show the two books that we discussed, because I think they're really great reads, and our audience will want to go out and get them. Professor Witt, thank you very much for this really engaging conversation and being with us here today. Thank you.
Thank you. My pleasure. My pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you very much. And thank you for joining us for this conversation with history.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.